City Institute at York University. I'm also a professor here at the Faculty of Environmental Studies. And I'm very happy that we could organize this city seminar with Professor David Holchansky today in this building. Glad that we were able to be hosted by FES to do this on short notice. And I'm glad you all found this room because we had to make a room change, and we are in for a very interesting presentation. It happens very rarely to academics, let me tell you. Those of you, I don't want to discourage you from becoming an academic, but it happens very rarely that your work, that you write, is read by more than five people. You write stuff for very obscure journals with very long names.
But that's why I have students. That's why I have students. They have to read it.
That's right. So they have to read it. But very rarely, you know, does anybody else read it. Every once in a while, it happens to an academic, such as Professor Holchansky, who writes something which is picked up all over the place, and it determines and defines a debate. So nobody who has any interest in cities, perhaps except for the mayor who doesn't understand the city very well yet, nobody who claims to know a little bit about Toronto can now also claim he hasn't heard of David Holchansky, because his project that he's going to talk to us about today has become, has a certain public notoriety now. We know about it because it's part of the public domain and public discourse. And it has, and that is the second thing which is very unusual, not only has it become well known, it also has determined and changed the way we think about Toronto. For good or for bad, we will have to see what we, you know, what we think of it, what we can do with it, but it has changed the way we look at Toronto. 20 years ago, when I came to Toronto, Toronto was looked at as a city without social segregation, a city without the kinds of problems that we normally consider to have south of the border, segregation, racialization in combination with social segregation, and polarized development of urban society. Now, 20 years later, it's not so easy to say that anymore, partly because we have the rich data of Professor Holchansky's work, and which he will talk to us about, and I won't say anything more. But I wanted to point that out. It's very important that this stuff gets out there and leaves the arcane world of scientific journals. So we'll hear more about that today, and as I said, I'm sure we're in for a very enjoyable presentation. Professor Holchansky is an Associate Director for Research at the University of Toronto's City Centre, and a professor of housing and community development in the Faculty of Social Work, where he holds the Dr. Chao Ye Ching Endowed Chair in Housing. His PhD is in urban planning. His teaching and research is focused on housing, homelessness, neighborhood change, and social policy, all areas in which he has made his mark over the years. He's the author of a recent report, The Three Cities Within Toronto, Income Polarization Among Toronto's Neighborhoods, and that report is sitting on the table right here for you to take when you leave the room. And also you can look at the Neighborhood Change website and look at other materials that have been generated out of this project. Today, we're going to hear about a particular aspect of a large and long-term research project Professor Holchansky has been involved in at the University of Toronto with colleagues. And the title of his talk today is Toronto's Third City, the Declining in the Inner Suburbs.
David. Well, thank you, Roger. Yeah. Thanks. Were any of you here, what, a year ago or so when I talked about the three cities in Toronto? I see some heads, yeah. So I'm not talking about that today. This is different. But this report is from that talk. The report is now out, and so I brought some copies of this. there's two starting comments I'd like to make about this project. Number one, it's an example of big social science. you often hear about big science, right, and all that, physicists doing this and that, right? But SHRC, the funding body here in Canada for Social Sciences and Humanities, has a few large grants. So we got a 5-year, $1 million grant to study the city of Toronto in great depth with a number of community partners and a nice academic team. So this has just been the best experience for me to be able to do that. Secondly, this is also the use of history. So when I write my proposals, I don't mention history in there. I also look for some historians as team members or something, right? But in order to understand where we're at now and where we should be going, don't we have to understand how we got here, where we were 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago? Yes, the answer is absolutely yes, to put things in some kind of perspective. Now, normally in small social science, small grants and all that, you can go back 10 or 15 years because it's difficult. There's a lot of work there. Here we have a data analyst and all that. I can't do any of this fancy statistical work, but members of the team do, and you hire somebody to do that. So anyways, it's history, and it's sort of big social science. And I'm talking about... I use the term the three cities in Toronto. I'll explain that in a moment. And today I'm going to talk about the third city, which is all around York University here, pretty much. So this is the... as we study Toronto, we no matter what we did, we ended up with seeing three clusters of people by socioeconomic status, ethnocultural origin. It all clustered in three groupings. And then naturally then came the title of the three cities in Toronto. This is embedded in what's called the divided cities literature, which began in the early 90s pretty much. Peter Marcuse out of Columbia, Ronald Van Kempen and Utrecht and a number of people like that, more or less had hypotheses about what's happening to cities. Before there was any detailed studies, of which this work is one. But they wrote about social-spatial polarization happening, income inequality growing, income polarization growing. I'll be mentioning all these. And then ethno-cultural and skin color segregation in our cities. But none of these things are new, right? And cities have always been divided. We've always had wealthy neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods, and all that. So the question is, what is new? And as I go through my presentation, I think you'll see that what they say here is what is new. There's a new social-spatial order with stronger and more rigid divisions and greater inequality, is the summary. Those changes may be summarized as an increase in the strength of divisions in the city and the inequality among them. So having 35 years worth of data allows us to see what the city was like, the different parts of the city back then and what it is now. And indeed, there's been very dramatic change in this relatively short period of time. In human history, 35 years is nothing, right? Or in the life of a city. But there's been very dramatic changes that I'll show you. So first, I want to talk about city number three, and that's the reddish-brown area on the map, 40% of the city, which are neighborhoods that have been going down in socioeconomic status for a long time. That's what distinguishes these three groupings. The blue area of city number one has been going up in socioeconomic status over time. And then the rest of the city is just in between, a little bit up, a little bit down, but not much. And this is a 35-year trend. And the city, as of 2005, the 2006 census, was divided this way. About 40% of the census tracts are in city number three and 40% in city number two. And then the wealthy part of the city is 20%. Now, I just have to correct myself. So the wealthy part of the city, the part of the city that is going up in average income and socioeconomic status. Because if you look south of Bloor Street and Danforth, those areas, there isn't great wealth there, but those census tracts are going up in socioeconomic status. That's basically gentrification happening down there. Whereas, you know, Rosedale and places like that, they've always been not only high income, but very wealthy and so on. So this is a trend map, 2 points in time. This is a trend in the city. So I want to talk about, show you some details about city number three. So a quick little summary then about city number three. As I said, it's 40% of Toronto. 370,000 housing units or households. I think things got mixed up here a little bit, but that's okay. 50% of all those dwellings are in high-rise buildings. There's 41,000 social housing units. Now, that sounds like a lot, but that's a bit more than 10%, and the city average is 10%. The city of Toronto, 10% of all housing in the city is non-market housing, co-ops, Toronto Community Housing, and all that. 1,070,000 people live in this city. 66% are visible minorities, and 15% are recent immigrants, meaning they arrived 2001 to 2006. So this is a large part of the city, a great number of people. I'll show you just this one picture of the CMA. This is the City of Toronto and the 905 area around Toronto, to show you that the census tracts that are going down in socioeconomic status exist in Brampton and Mississauga, and then those that are going up are around, of course, in Oakville and places like that. So we haven't yet studied the 905 completely. In 1970, even in 75, there wasn't too much out there, right, except in some of the older parts of Mississauga and Brampton. Now, this is now a map with 1 point in time, because I want to make a distinction here. The city has low-income neighborhoods, of course, and we define them as census tracts that are 80% or less of the average income for that census year. And so this map colors those census tracts, and the gray does show up here. So what I'm doing here is showing you that for what we call city number three is not all of the poor areas of the city, and not all of city number three is necessarily low income. But you can see the text down below. It turns out that 88% of city number three's census tracts are low income. So it is basically a low income part of the city. And in fact, over 2/3 of all low income census tracts in the entire city of Toronto are in city number three. Okay, so the brown on the map is city number three, and they're low income census tracts. If it wasn't low income, the 12% that aren't, they're colored gray. Okay, so that's a key thing to remember, that the three-city map is a trend map, 2 points in time. It's not necessarily that the blue area is high income. It tends to be, right? And the brown area is low income, but it tends to be to this extent. Now, on the back of that report I gave you is this decade by decade and half decade at the bottom there. Remember the quote I had about dramatic change in the social spatial divisions in the city? In 1970, 1980, all the yellow areas on the maps are middle income. That is, we define that simply as within 20% of the average income for that year. So we were a middle income city, a vast majority middle income city back then, and you can see by 2000, 2005, we're not any longer a middle-income city. The red areas are low-income areas. So we go from being 66% middle-income to only 29% middle-income, and now a majority, 53% of all the 500 and some census tracts are low-income. Okay, again, not using a poverty measure, but they're well below the average income, whereas in 1970, 1980, the vast majority were middle-income. And that's a way of saying a city that is majority middle income, a society that is majority middle income, is a good way to go. And we're not going that way. We were going that way after World War II up until the 1980s, but we're not doing that any longer. And all these maps and numbers and all that clearly show that. Here now, to mention Transit City. I don't know where Transit City is. When before Ford became mayor and was critical of Transit City, the premier unfortunately killed, as many of you would know, the Finch West Line, and was it the Jane Line also? But in any case, here was city number 3 on that map, and those green lines are the proposed Transit City lines. And you see how they do nicely connect up large parts of city number 3 to the rest of the city of Toronto. But we may not be doing much of that. And so that's very sad. One solution for having a better and more inclusive city is, in fact, linking everybody with rapid transit, whether it's the new kind of streetcars or subways. Most cities do that, and we haven't been doing it. And and my note at the bottom there is that if city number 3 was a separate census metropolitan area in Canada, it would be the fourth largest. Ottawa, Edmonton, Calgary are all about 1,100,000 or so, just like city number 3. So if this was a city on its own, and yet it doesn't have transit, it doesn't have all kinds of things that a big census, a big metropolitan area would have. And I put the amalgamated city's coat of arms there. Diversity, our strength. Okay, but where does diversity live? City number 1, the 20% of the city, is 82% white. 2% black, 2% South Asian, mixture of others. So it's hard to find anybody who's not white living in that 20% of the city. City number 3 is one-third white, and then this is the diversity of Toronto. So diversity really lives in city number 3. City number 2, as I said, is a sort of in-between area, and you can see the numbers sort of show that. Parts of city number 2 in each census end up being going up and being like city number 1, or go down in socioeconomic status and join city number 3. So that city number 2 keeps getting smaller. And then recent immigrants. When I've done my three cities talk. This is the first time I'm doing the third city, focused on the third city. But all the times I've done my talk about the three cities in Toronto, different audiences, a bunch of audiences, especially those who are a bit older and more well-off and all that, immediately do what? Yeah, they say, yeah, these are not good trends. This is a divided city, and it's because of immigration and immigrants. And there's no connection. Think about it. What's the logic of a statement like that? I'll show you part of the illogic here. Here's one way we can demonstrate this, that the top map and pie graph is 1971. So in the 6 years prior to that census, 285,000 immigrants settled in Toronto. And the population in Toronto was way lower at that time than it is now. And in the most recent 5 years, 450,000 newcomers settled in Toronto in the 5 years before 2006. Well, that's in the same ballpark, right? And especially given the size of the cities, I haven't computed that. I think it's probably more immigrants were coming as a percentage of Toronto back then than today, but I have to check that one, okay? So we've always been receiving immigrants. So how does anything that I'm talking about here have to do with the fact that we have a bunch of immigrants? Now, some of you could think quickly and say, yeah, if I was an immigrant in 1970, 1965, 70, 75, the economy was very different. There were lots of good jobs. We didn't even have the term good jobs, bad jobs. If you had a job, you got paid, you got job benefits usually, and all that. The service sector wasn't very large. Minimum wage jobs were truly just some part-time jobs, mainly for students and all that, right? So our economy was way different back then than it is now when you come. So anyways, we receive a lot of immigrants. We grow rapidly because of immigrants. But then you can see from pie charts, too, that the inner suburbs back in 71 received 45% of all these immigrants, and these same inner suburbs received 49%. So this area that is roughly city number three that I'm talking about has always been the place where immigrants settle. How does Toronto grow? These days only by immigration. And then in city number three, as I said, you won't find too many black people living in city number one. It happens that 8.4% of the city of Toronto, on the census form, the people checked off the box saying they were black. Okay, so 8.4%. So the light red, the pink area on the map, is less than that 8.4%, and the red area is 8.4% or 16% to 16%, and then it's more than double in the dark red areas on this map. Okay, so there is a concentration of people by skin color happening, and especially in city number three. So then, there's four groupings in city number three I want to tell you about. Because as soon as we looked at this and understood cities one, two, and three, we said, boy, 40% of the city, they can't all be alike, right? That's a big chunk of the city, and it just can't all be alike. So how do we separate them? It's called a K-means cluster analysis, which I can't do. But Larry Bourne and Bob Murdy from York University, some of my colleagues and others, know all that stuff. And this PowerPoint will be available on your website. PDF of this is a very last page explains how we took something like 31 variables and ran this cluster analysis, and we end up with four fairly similar areas within city number three, meaning they're somewhat distinct from each other also, right? So that's the whole point, that they're distinct from each other and similar within themselves. And so it happens that, so we call them 3A, B, C, and D. By the way, the reason we call it City 1, 2, and 3, do you want to try to give them names? In the literature, Pierre Marcuse talks about the citadel for the wealthy area, right? And anyways, you can have a bunch of names that are pejorative to both the rich and the poor if you want to give them names, right? You use the word ghetto and stuff like that, which is not. So anyways, I'm very happy we ended up with 1, 2, and 3. And then we have A, B, C, and D now. City 3A, 3B, 3C, 3D. So I'll briefly say a few things about this. It happens that, you see the little box here, the low-income cutoff. So this is a poverty measure. This is after-tax, low-income cutoff. The average in the city is 19% of all census tracts are low-income by that definition. And it happens that in A and B, that's the average, but then C and D, it's 31%. So there's already one distinction for parts of this big 40% is that A and B are not as much low income as C and D is. And then A and B have a fair amount in common. You can know if it shows up clearly, it's not too clear there, is it? The dark purple is basically northern Scarborough. It's this area up in the northwest corner, and almost only in that northwest corner. So that was the last area built in the city of Toronto. It was developed last. The houses are somewhat newer. And then it's an area with lots of Chinese, probably large families and extended families and all that. So that makes it distinct from the 3B there. But in both these cases, you have, look at A, predominantly large two-parent households of higher socioeconomic status relative to the city, not well off, but relative to city number three, living in newer owner-occupied housing, many foreign-born non-whites, especially Chinese, in group A there. In group B, which is pretty much the rest and out towards the west side of the city, predominantly two-parent households, again, more seniors of average socioeconomic status living in older owner-occupied housing, lower, smaller number of foreign-born people, and a higher white population than in A. Anyways, the cluster analysis delivers all these takes. This is certainly handy for service providers and all that to think about. It's one thing to say, here's a part of the city that is falling in socioeconomic status, but then here are four distinctions, and by age, by family status, by a variety of things. So C and 3C and 3D are interesting. It's high density generally, and it's those clusters of high rises, and it's renters. So predominantly two-parent households of mixed socioeconomic status, higher educated, living in rental apartments, more foreign-born, recent immigrants, South Asians, and other non-white visible minorities. The key thing that stands out is higher educated, recent immigrants. So we all know about credentials not being recognized and people coming here with incredible credentials and education and all that and it not showing up in income. Well, it shows up in the census. A cluster of people with high educations without high incomes. And it's showing up in City 3C. Group City 3D is predominantly two-parent households, but a relatively high proportion of single-parent families very low socioeconomic status, blue-collar jobs, lower education levels, living in rental apartments and social housing, more children, higher percentage of black and non-white visible minorities there. So they sort of sound somewhat similar, but there's these distinctions in the four groups there. So now I'm going to show income inequality in the city of Toronto and in city number three. This, some of you have seen before, this is simply the three cities once again, showing how the income inequality refers to the gap between rich and poor. So the gap between rich and poor in 1970 was relatively small. Because if you remember what I said earlier, most of the city was middle income. So if most is middle income, yeah, you have some high and some low, but it means the gap is pretty small. Over time, you can see the gap opening up there. And you can see city number three, the brown line there, going from middle income to lower income as a group. And I'll disaggregate that shortly. So here's another way of looking at income. I say trends here, but the previous map was the trends. This is now 2005. So I have in blue the individual income, and in green, light green, household income, comparing the two. So first is the city of Toronto at one end. Then you have city number one, city number two, and city number three. So you do see the difference in the three groupings here. And then for city number three, A, B, C, and D, you can notice how A and B are somewhat similar, very similar, whereas C and D then are similar to themselves over there. So the priority neighborhoods. It happens that the designation by the City of Toronto and the United Way of priority neighborhoods, it's half of what I call city number three is priority neighborhoods because they took large clusters of census tracts and called it a neighborhood. And so the priority neighborhoods tends to have the average profile of city number three in almost every case. Just a little fact there. So again, you can see in all maps and analysis, we use individual income, and we're often asked why, and we don't use household income. And the reason is that we're looking at the socioeconomic status of who lives where in the city, and so the beginning of socioeconomic status is, in fact, your individual income. It's not always a good match. You know, if you're highly educated and upwardly mobile, you know, your income will be going up, or will be higher than somebody else's. So individual income tends to match nicely and fit in with other measures of socioeconomic status. Household income works too, but it's more imperfect because in a household you can have more than two adult earners. Okay, so you have two, three, or four people earning money, extended household, the teenagers are working or whatever, and so you show up as a higher income household, but you're not higher socioeconomic status. So that's why we use individual income. In this report, we explain that if we do all our maps with household income or with employment income, we end up with the same maps. We end up with the same graphs within 2% or so, 2 or 3%. You know, there'll be a little bit of here and there change because of the different measures, but nothing changes. The City of Toronto has 2.5 million people, 1 million households, so it's a very large N that we're talking about here. So there's nothing subtle here. You don't need any kind of statistics about reliability or all that. The gaps are so large in all of this. So then, here's what we did for city number three: is there's the four groups over time now, A, B, C, and D. From 1970 to 2005. They were, Mark, the 100% will be middle income. And again, from the other stuff I showed you, city number three was basically middle income and it's fallen. But here now you disaggregate those. And you can see how the two purple, A and B, are so sort of similar now. And same with C and D, though we're at the bottom. So just to orient yourself, the average income in 2005 for Toronto was $40,000. And City 3D is $23,500 here at the bottom. So the average income of that group of census tracts. So that's the income gap. Polarization is something different. It's related. It's where you have your distribution of income, and a good distribution usually is a big middle, right, and a small high end and a small low end. You know, wealthy people, poor people, big middle. Well, we went from that big middle to having a big bottom and a bigger top end. So that's polarization. So that has definitely happened here. And these are the bar graphs that are in this report, and then I'm going to show you city number three, some of these trends. It's the middle income group now. Remember, the middle income we define just objectively for each of the census years. If a census tract was on average within 20% of the average for that year, it's middle income, period. Then it's either low or high after that fact. So here's what happened. This is now the entire city of Toronto went from that 66% middle-income city down to 29% in the last census. And you'll notice the biggest fall was in the 1990s. And we can all think about what happened in the 1990s to average and low-income people. 1995, Mike Harris elected. The early 90s was a recession. But then a real tough neoliberal policies and cutbacks in all the 1990s shows up in the 2001 census, right? And then where did people go? Well, the upper end, you see, went from 7 to 15%, the very high end. And the low end went from nothing, 1%, to 13%. And the majority going to the low, as opposed to very low end, 18 to 40%. But it's interesting that this here is actually fallen, right? And showing up more here. So yellow is the most recent census. So the city is majority of census tracts, 53%, and the yellows, the 13% or 53% of the census tracts are low or very low income. So you're well below middle income. And then we doubled the top, 7 to 15%. So when we first saw this, so when Richard, our data analyst, brought this out, and I was struggling to figure out how to show or see if the middle did decline, and of course a bar chart is a good way to do it. So when he brought this up, well, what's the first hypothesis is, well, maybe all those middle-income people are living in 905, and the city is increasingly full of poor people and some wealthy people, right? But so we do the same thing for 905, and here it is. I just showed you, this is the one you just saw, and then there is 905. So the same trend in the middle in 905. So if 905 had all the middle-income people, there would be even more middle-income. But they're not. They're now 20% low-income. So the fall is the same, not as sharp. They start out at 86%, they're down to 61% and falling. But they go from no low-income census tracts to 20% of all 905 are now that low-income category. So at this point, I'd like to raise the term middle class versus middle income. We hear in the news all the time about the shrinking middle class or the middle class, this or that. Well, basically from World War II, 45 until about 1985, we were building a middle income society, and then people called it middle class. Because how does one define class and all that? I use the term middle income, and I'm telling you that my research team, we use this definition that if you're within 20% plus or minus of the average for that year, we'll call that the middle. It's a pretty big middle, too, 40%, right? So we define that as the middle. You can define middle income as a researcher, but define it and defend it. Okay, but middle class, how do you define middle class? So the thing is, most people call themselves middle class, but they're not middle income any longer. They used to be middle income, but now they call themselves middle class, but they can't afford the middle class lifestyle, right? The middle income, middle class person in the 50s and 60s, one job would buy a house, feed four or five or six kids with a wife staying at home, have one or two cars in a suburban house, North York or you know, Etobicoke, Scarborough, or whatever, right? And no longer will one job, one average job do that. One middle income job won't do that, can't do that. But that's the way things were. So we have this mismatch. People still consider themselves middle class, but they're not middle income and don't quite realize that. And things just aren't working out well. So there's all this resentment then. So then one can speculate Rob Ford's election. You know, here's a maverick sort of saying, I'm going to kick butt, or I'm going to get those elitists, I'm going to do this or that, like Sarah Palin. It's not clear what they're going to do. But the status quo isn't any good for the vast majority. So somebody promising to shake things up can have some appeal when there's growing resentment, frankly, and dissatisfaction. So this is 905 and the city. And now, remember the cities 1, 2, 3. I subdivided the city here. And it's what you would expect. The very high income group in city number 1, 70% of the census tracts are well above average income. And that part of the city goes from having some low and very low income census tracts to having none. And the middle cut in half. So that's what the map's showing. This is what. Whereas city number 3 was, as I've been saying all along, in 1970, this historic trend here, they started off as middle income. All those houses were built for that middle income, middle class family out here. And but that rapidly disappeared. But look at that, 85% to 12%, and it all showing up at the bottom. They have no top. There's just nobody now. There's no. Part of this is tautological in that this is what we're looking for. So I'm just putting it on a graph so you can see it. But it's just so dramatic, the change. So that's what's interesting here. You have 35 years worth of change on these graphs. And city number 2 is just in between. It happens to be always 10% below the middle. And this sort of shows it. It's just stuck in that middle. And here's a close-up of city number 3, since we're talking about that. So look at that. Almost 90% are low or very low income, on average, the census tracts. Now we'll look at these. It's a bit much to absorb, but look at 3A and 3B are sort of similar. The middle, they were middle, and then they fell, right? here and here from there down, and then they grow at the low end, but not the very low end. So A and B share that in common with some other social demographic differences. C and D have something else in common. In fact, it's interesting that this cluster, C, was like the others back in 1970, but is not like the others now, mainly very low income. And here too, this is where you have a concentration of social housing, along with, I think, pretty poor quality high-rise rental buildings. So they were always low income, but now they're very low income down in there. So this is the way the four clusters in city number three, the third city, break up.
Questions,
not comments, but questions or clarifications? The maps and graphs are pretty clear, I think, right? And it's so then I'm showing you all these trends, but in fact we've known about these trends. That's another thing about social science research. We who study these things tend to know this, and it takes a while for society to see it or ignore policy advice from those who study these things. And a classic study from 1979, 1980 was our Social Planning Council of Metro Toronto, now called Social Planning Toronto, released this report, Metro Suburbs in Transition. And this was 1979, they released that report. And look at the cover. I'll go one more. This is the cover outline of what they were talking about in that report, and look at how well it matches to city number three, the outline there. That using only 1976 census, 71 and 66, they could see what was beginning to happen. More single-parent families, more low-income families, all kinds of things happening in the traditional suburbs, which are always husband and wife and five kids and two cars. And that landscape was built for that. That's why there isn't transit there, and eventually there were buses, but it's a car-oriented, it's this modernist post-war landscape. So they got it quite right there. And I just finished my PhD at that time, and I remember the mayor of North York and the suburban mayors all in denial, sort of. No, we're just fine and all that. We're not becoming like the city of Toronto with its inner city problems, poor people and all that. We're not like that. We're this middle class haven, sort of, right? The map there let's assume this is 1994. Okay, this is February 1994. So that means we have the 91 census and prior. Okay, so we don't know about all this stuff that's happened since. So if my team existed then and we did what we have now done, but we did it in 1994, that's the map, the three city map we would have gotten. And I don't think we would have called it three cities. So I put the numbers on there, 1, 2, 3, but I'm not sure we would have called it cities 1, 2, and 3. Because look at the scattering of the high income, the areas trending high income. Some of them are no longer trending that way. So anyways, this map would simply have told us, hey, there's something happening in the northeast corner there, in the northwest corner, right? Something different that was traditionally downtown, inner city. Something's happening out there. We would have seen a little bit of that. So anyway, so that's a nice little exercise we did to see... to look at that. And now I'll show you that one you just saw. Assume it's 1994. This is the one in the book, the Three Cities in Toronto. And then this is a projection to 2025. And it's described on the last two pages of the report. The assumptions here are if nothing changes. That's the big assumption. If nothing changes, because we study these trends, and so with 35 years worth of history supporting us, we can say if nothing changes, city number two will begin to disappear, because we know parts of it are already a little bit like city number three, and they're going to become city number three, and parts of city number two are already a little bit like city number one, and they're going to become city number one. You see, city number one grows. Instead of 20%, city number one becomes 30% of the city, and then city number three becomes 60% of the city instead of 40%, and there's nothing much left in between, 10%. So again, that's a big if. If nothing changes, that's where we're heading. And then a little technical note is we don't know how quickly. We call it 2025. We have no way of figuring out how slowly or how quickly that will happen. Just that this is in scale with the change that we saw before. So we sort of kept that 10, 20-year timeline there. It could happen sooner. It could happen later, if it happens at all. But if nothing changes, that's where we're heading, because that is the trend. Now, and then I'm often asked, okay, this is fairly gloomy, right? This is not very pleasant. Is it happening elsewhere? Well, we don't have great evidence, but see, there are two clusters of Western nations, and we can't compare ourselves to non-Western nations. There are two clusters of Western nations, Anglo-American ones, UK, Ireland, Australia, Canada, US, and all that. It happens that those nations, going back 20, 30, even 40 years, have double the income gap now between rich and poor, as do most of the Western Europe and Northern European countries. Those countries have about half the income gap that we have. Okay? So if you enter the 1980s, neoliberal period, period of state cutbacks, period of changing job markets, part-time jobs, deindustrialization and all that, with such a big gap between rich and poor, it's going to have more of a dramatic impact on the city and on people than if that happens to you and first you have a bigger welfare state and second you have a very small gap between rich and poor. So anyways, this is from a UK study that draws the same conclusions as we do about Toronto. So these are from that study, but this is a summary of our three cities research that both poverty and wealth have become increasingly spatially concentrated, in our case since 1971. Rich and poor households are increasingly clustering together in different areas. All the maps show that. The average, and by that, middle income is my term. The middle income group of households has gradually diminished in size during that period. Poor, rich, and middle income households begin progressively less likely to live next door to one another in that period. That's what's happened in Toronto, and that's what some research about the UK is finding. In the US, the Brookings Institute has a little project on change in the inner suburbs of American metropolitan areas. Very few of the suburbs, let's say the vast majority of the suburbs were white by 1980, 16% non-white, but now one-third non-white. What they call the first suburbs, by that they mean the suburbs, first suburbs after World War II, the suburbs like around York University here, right? City number three suburbs. So, and that's a nice statement about that cluster of the inner suburbs. Neither fully urban nor completely suburban, America's older inner ring suburbs have a unique set of challenges, such as concentrations of elderly and immigrant populations, as well as outmoded housing and commercial buildings, very different from those of the center city. So again, in Anglo-American countries, we're seeing similar trends, and just a little bit in this direction in other countries. So anyways, we've known about this for some time, and I just feature a couple reports here. The Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives has a number of nice reports on their website about the rise of Canada's richest 1%, the growing gap, what's wrong with inequality. And here's the TD Bank just recently, Toronto's economic recovery leaving many behind. So they nicely document how the bottom 20 or 30 or 40% are not doing much better in this recent 2-year recovery. And you know that they don't do very well during a recession, and they're not doing very well during the recovery either, which is continuing the trend, right, of exacerbating the gap between rich and poor. Now, there's a nice 2005 economic paper, American Economic Review there. This is Canada's tax filer data from 1920 on. You see, before World War II, there was a large working class, poorly paid, and the top 5% had most of the income. After World War II, we built that middle-income society, and we became even a bit more equal, okay, that top 5% were taking less up until 1985. And then it just takes off, especially for the top 1% and all that. The income and the wealth, we don't have good measures of wealth, we do have of income. So it's what I'm showing you about Toronto happened basically from about 1985 on, the 1980s on. And the optimistic side is it didn't happen all at once. All kinds of changes happened year after year after year. Government budgets, things in the private sector, quality jobs, what jobs pay, all those things is what was changing in that period. Any of you use Google's Ngram viewer? It came out in December out of Harvard and a few places like that. With Google, Google's scanning all these books. You line up every word in every book by year, and you have this algorithm about adjusting things and all that. You put any words in there, and it'll show you the number of or a percentage of books that use that word. Okay, so it's a nice way of looking at culture. See, our culture, up until 1980, did not use the word privatization much. Right? That's a product of recent times. Globalization, of course, and deregulation. These are all new terms, and these are all literal examples of what of changes in our society after 1985. There are many more, of course, but that's... So then, I think finally, implications and options, what do you do about this? Now, we can explain these things... And this is, I think, an important paper a couple years back, Ronald Van Kempen, Divided Cities in the 21st Century, Challenging the Importance of Globalization. He makes, I think, a solid case, I agree with him, that we've thrown around the word globalization too easily in the past, blaming all kinds of things at globalization. A lot of what happened to Toronto is made in Toronto. I mean, made in Canada, not Toronto, made in Canada. Not all of these things that happened here. Canada could have changed them. Some of you might know about Germany and the German economy, in fact, how well they're doing and how they protect certain industries and all kinds of stuff like that. We could do something like that, but we didn't. But anyways, this is a list of things that are different in each country, and in a country as large as Canada with provinces a bit different in each province, perhaps. So these things affect how divided the city is, what the divisions are, and all that. Now, why worry about more rigid social spatial divisions and greater inequality? So I'm always asked that. And it's not something to answer easily or quickly, right? But I like what from Richard Wilkinson here. I think this is a nice summary of what's wrong. See, inequality promotes strategies in a society that are more self-interested, less affiliative, often highly antisocial, more stressful, and likely to give rise to higher levels of violence, poor community relations, and worse health. Right? As the gap grows between people, social distance grows between people. So some people don't care as much about other people, and in fact there is the other, right? It's not us. It's me and them and them and them, right? And that's the argument, one argument for what's wrong with all this. And for a city, it's where we're so close together, quite serious. Implications, we can all think about all the implications. It's no surprise that we see more guarded enclaves and some people studying the gated communities, condos with their guards and all kinds of things locked down, right, to protect some people from other people and all that. high crime in some areas and not in other areas. So what can we do about these trends? So very quickly, I'm going to show you a list that we came up with first of what could some a few things that could be done in the city that will be important. But then we thought about it, and you could do all those things and it won't make too much of a difference. It'll make a difference, but not too much. Why? These four things are what caused, I think, the divided city that you see now, that I'm showing you, and the third city having the characteristics that it has. 40% of Toronto, 1 million people having the characteristics of what I've shown you here. We stripped down our income support programs. Unemployment insurance doesn't cover as many people and not as much for as long and all that. Social assistance and all that. We're not protecting people in hard times. We don't talk about discrimination. And we're a city more or less half white and half not white. And there is discrimination in housing, there is discrimination in employment and in education, and we're not doing too much to address that. Affordable housing, we used to build 25,000 social housing units until 1993. City of Toronto gets 3,000 or 4,000 new social housing units every year. 10 years, that's 30,000 or 40,000 units of affordable housing. We have 80,000 people or something on households on a waiting list. Well, we wouldn't have that kind of waiting list if we were just adding to the affordable stock little by little over time. And then finally, the labor market. Minimum wage jobs, deregulation, part-time work, no benefits, you name it, all that happened in the last 20 years or so. It wasn't the case. After World War II, it was the opposite. It was protecting workers, right? And we introduced social assistance and of course, the health care plan and all that in the 60s to protect workers, unemployment insurance. And then we strip it all back. And it shows up on the maps then. So there's just four things, four big things. And then smaller things, inclusionary zoning. How do you mix up the wealthy part of the city? Well, some rental housing, some social housing. Rental housing rehabilitation, we have a huge stock of aging high-rise buildings. Half the people in City Number 3 live in those high-rise buildings that were built 40 years ago, 40 and 50 years ago. I don't want to go through the whole list here. Tower renewal is a major initiative, I'll come to that. And you see we've got a bunch of pretty small things then, and that's why they won't make much difference. That what's causing the problem are what things that the province and the federal government have done, as well as the private sector. This is a reference here to tower renewal. We have an astounding 1,200 rental high-rise buildings in Toronto. Most people didn't realize this too many years ago. 1,200 of these slab high-rises. This does not count the new condos. These are those 20-story buildings built in the 50s and 60s. They're mainly in clusters of five or so. 280, over half of all renters in the city live in them, and as I said, half the renters in City Number 3 live in them. There's few community services, there are aging buildings, often overcrowded, of course, energy inefficient, and so it's called Tower Neighborhood Renewal now, because there's open space there. You can do some infill housing, so you never have wealthy people living there, you can have middle-income people living there. And mix up those neighborhoods and bring in some shopping and some workplaces and shops and all that into these clusters of high rises. So I think this is Toronto's future, a good 10 or 20 year program. Europe has already done a lot of this, but Toronto hasn't. Now in North America, no other city has what Toronto has. This was called a fluke of having a metropolitan government and a certain zoning system and certain builders who got into the swing of building those 20-story slab high-rises, we got a lot of them. New York City has more tall apartment buildings, of course, because it's New York City and it's been around for a long time and all that. But Toronto then, next is Toronto, no other city has this, except for Europe and Japan, clusters of high-rises. And they've been retrofitting them and improving them in Europe regularly, but we're not. Setting priorities, we're, you know, who sets priorities. So good, we got the Pan Am bid, the games. Somehow they came up with $1.4 billion for that. But then we had a squeeze on the budget, of course. Okay, so what got scrapped was city number three, transit, was the first thing that was cut by the province a year or so ago. So I'm closing now, and this is Mark Kingwell, some of you know of, U of T philosophy professor, a bunch of interesting books of a cultural philosopher, but an article in the Walrus a couple years ago. Just city demands over and over that all development be at some level in the service of everyone. And it hasn't been. Our planning process, what we build, how we build, who we build for, and all that isn't in service of everyone. And just look at the Transit City example also of what's happening. So that is my presentation there. So I painted you a quick picture of city number three. We do have a list of 100 variables of every sort of census category of each of the four and all that that we'll be publishing in a booklet like this pretty soon, featuring just city number three. So as I said, this is my first presentation of this, so I'm happy to answer any questions, hear any comments.
Yes. I like the fact that you brought up differentiating between the middle class and the middle income earners, because it goes back to what Marx was saying, it's just pure ideology. Whose interests and who benefits in terms of, I guess, the political or economic dimensions, and of course cultural, because it's promoting a certain lifestyle and way of life that not everyone has access to.
I think that's why I have that quote from Kingwell, that we're not doing that. And to some degree, I don't want to glorify the past. You know, the good old days weren't very good at all, okay? But after World War II, we were building this middle-income, middle-class society. All the numbers show that the vast majority of us were in that middle and free to do whatever we wanted, but we had access to all the things that one would want as a middle-class person, right? But that was taken away, right, by the economy and by government policy and politics and power politics, yeah. Yes?
In the power renewal initiative, given that most of the powers are privately owned, what kind of incentives, planning or policy, would you see in order for developers to build in less desirable areas? Because I see it happening maybe along the subway line or the subway extension, but then how would they sell if they build infill housing? How would they
sell in the private market? Right. See, many, not all, of the slab high-rises that are in the nicer parts of the city have already been renovated by the private sector because they can charge more rents. Okay? And in city number three, I showed you the income levels, right? You can't charge more rents. So what do you do? To get... These are in clusters of four or five. Often one or two will be social housing, not always. But some of the clusters will be one or two towers that are owned. So land in the tower is already owned by Toronto Community Housing. So that's a plus. But then these require rehabilitation, not just renovation, you know, not just new kitchen cabinets, the elevators, the pipes, all that, right? And they have so much open space around them. So you can do... For the private sector, you could give them a rezoning to build some a condo of some size or row or stacked townhouses on some of the open space in exchange for subsidizing renewal of their tower. Okay, but tower renewal won't happen without the federal government having a really big residential rehabilitation assistance program. It's called RAP, R-R-A-P. It's a 30 or 40 year old program. It's very small. Residential assistance program, yeah. So it's federal money, and what the deal is, they say to owners of rental buildings, the city of Toronto gets a little bit of this money every year, so some old rental building, you strike a deal with the owner, your building needs work. Here's some money. what you got to do is an exchange. There's a 15-year agreement of keeping rents at a certain reasonable level. You get this federal subsidy. You do your part as a good landlord for those 15 years. All is forgiven and all that. But you don't. You could be punished by, you know, because take back a loan or something, and a loan becomes a grant. So there's very simple, good formulas for doing that. And they said all over Europe this has gone on. They know how to fix these buildings technically, make them more energy efficient. We know all that stuff. We're just not doing it yet. So it's highly feasible because of all the land. Okay, and wealthy people won't necessarily want to live in northern Etobicoke or northern Scarborough. Okay, but middle-income people, there's still some middle-income people. The decline, right? They're still there, right? To build some modest condos, to build some ownership, you know, stacked townhouses, stuff like that. Commuting distances being what they are, and especially if you had transit coming in there, the light rail and all that, right? Those neighborhoods could quickly become quite desirable. You have some shops there. You have a few places for people to make a living. You know, so people who sew, people who do all kinds of services for others, right, need some space. So there's all these plans, all kinds of architects, urban gardens, you know, urban agriculture and all that is all part of this also. So I think sooner than later, this is the big... I think it is the big solution for City Number 3, for mixing up City Number 3 and for improving half the housing in City Number 3. Half the housing is in those high-rise slabs, rental slabs. Yeah, is that? Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, so it makes sense.
A little louder, please.
Yeah. It makes sense for mixing up City Number 3, but do we then just accept City Number 1 as an objective fact? What about mixing up
yeah.
City Number 1? What can be done?
Inclusionary zoning, or people prefer the term inclusionary housing. What it means is we know right now, where are they building those nice condos that tend to be 40 or 50 stories, some of them, you know, 20, 40 stories? Pretty much in City Number 1, right? So if you mandated that, sure, go ahead and build it, but 20% of the units must be rental, or it must be modest ownership, or ideally social housing, if there was a social housing program, but there isn't one. So then you introduce a different demographic, 20% or 15% of the units. And you talk to developers, the Daniels Group, Mitch Cohen, or we've talked to a bunch of them. All they say, yep, as long as the same rules apply to everybody. It can't be, let's make a deal. You know, some developers don't have to do it, and other developers have to do it, right? So it just changes zoning bylaw. The province doesn't want to give the city the clear authority to do that. There's a bill. I think it's not a government bill in the legislature here to give the city authority to do that. People who build condos are happy building what they're building, and they have a lot of influence, right? And so they build for this monoculture of yeah. Yes. Oh. Yeah.
No, I just a couple of questions. The first one was it's interesting that you pointed out Armin's paper, because in the paper she argues that income gaps have grown because progressive taxation has declined and because the wealthy have got very wealthy, and that's part of the reason why the gap has grown. So that strikes me that was interesting to use average income, because average income is pulled up by the rich getting richer. And if you actually use median income, as she makes the argument for an appropriate measure, it might be slightly different. I don't want to say slightly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're dramatizing something that may not be as dramatic as first appears. But that's the first question. You can come back and comment on it. The second one is, you know, when you see this over time, this is really a pattern of people moving from place to place and jurisdictions changing. You didn't mention amalgamation, but it's intriguing that the amalgamated areas are of the distant towns of Scarborough and so on and so forth. Are those where planning was done by, you know, governments who didn't really know what they were doing? They thought they were building suburbs, and you know, that's where all the poor people are. So, I mean, in a sense, this movement around of people, which is what the pattern from 70 to 2005 shows, is this failure of planning. You know, I think it would just come back to the point that you mentioned. I think it needs to be emphasized a lot more, the failure of planning, because governments were segmented, because we didn't have a municipal authority planning with a larger regional view, because planners are in the thrall of developers to a certain extent, as you alluded to before. I mean, I'm not at all optimistic about developers building building, you know, rental units and condos. I mean, that's, they don't do it now because the Planning Act actually says the 25%, as you know, the government's, the Planning Act said that 25% of new housing has to be has to be affordable. Which of course means nothing.
Right.
And, you know, just and means the developer throws up a row of connected houses. So, you know, all of those things strike me that, you know, you don't come back to the planning issue enough.
Okay.
In the presentation, now, fair enough, you probably do it elsewhere, but I think the default is there. And so then it's political, relationship between
politicians. Good, thanks. Median income first. We don't have median income going all the way back. It's something StatsCan has to calculate. Now, we have it going back about 3 censuses or 4 censuses, and we ran some tests and didn't make any difference other than a 2 or 3% difference. But a few that keeps on coming up, so I'm going to have some like little working paper, right, that will run it for as long as we can and see what is different, right? Compare the average individual to the median when we have it and all that. There'll be a couple percent difference. We'll name that, show it, table that issue. Because someone on a McLean's blog, without ever calling me or asking me anything, saw me make reference to, well, we don't have median going all the way back, and then made a big deal that this is probably all hogwash because it really should be median. I know you're not saying that, no, but that's what people can say, right, who want to be deniers. Planning, yeah. But the planners, North York, Etobicoke, they had planners. Planners planned. Those are ideal planned neighborhoods of the 1950s. Okay? The peanut there, what's that area called and all that? Right, they were laid out by planners and architects. And that was the state of the art at the time. It's like the current Regent Park that's being torn down was a state of the art for the 1940s. Put apartment buildings in open space. And that's where we get the high-rise buildings, the Corbusier type in Toronto, the apartment buildings with open space around them. That was good. And we know it's not, right? Yeah, so what I say about this landscape, see, Toronto has three basic landscapes, Greater Toronto now, the whole metropolitan area. There is the old city of Toronto, that 19th century, early 20th century city. Then there's the post-war suburbs all through Mississauga and elsewhere, including city number 3 here. And then there's the new suburbs, which are at higher density and they're a bit different. I don't think they're any better or anything, but they're a bit different landscapes. So traditionally, after World War II, people who were coming middle class, middle income, wanted a new house. I remember my parents they first lived in the city, not the city, but in the inner city, sort of in an old little house, had lots of problems, and took 5 years or so to buy that house in the subdivision, okay? That's what people wanted, and that's what city number 3 really is right now, that kind of house. So today, for people who want that new house in a subdivision, they have to go way out, you know, Vaughan and all kinds of other places further out. They're not going to go to city number 3 because that's old housing, and they're not going to go to city number 1 that's even older and it's not their lifestyle, right? So I think we have consumers who like the 19th century city, so they buy and bid up and gentrify downtown. And we still have all kinds of people who want and like the suburban lifestyle, but they don't get it. They don't buy in city number 3. They buy new, out in new subdivisions.
But is that the cost? I mean, paradoxically, these are city number 3, but the houses are still ferociously expensive.
Relatively. No, that's another ironic, excellent point. But it's ironic, isn't it? That they're not slums.
No.
See, so they would be really cheap if they were really run down and all that. Okay, so we don't have slums, they're not slums. So they are way cheaper than downtown, but still not cheap. You know, you got to have a good income to qualify for a mortgage to buy a house at Jane and Finch, frankly. Okay, and it's going to be way cheaper than elsewhere, but it's still not cheap. So that is part of the dilemma here. So that's why all the overcrowding in the rental buildings. So anybody in social agencies knows how every 1, 2, 3 bedroom apartment, not every, a whole lot of them are just full of extended families, 2 families, and all that, for that reason. So this is that squeeze sort of, you know. Final point is that I was trying to... money buys choice. So when anybody... I'd like to envision somebody walking across the border of the city of Toronto. They just moved to the city of Toronto, and you look around. Where will I live? Right? Well, what determines where you will live? The amount of money you have to either buy or rent. Okay? So money buys choice. A lot of money, live wherever you want. And people with a lot of money are living in city number one, frankly. They're choosing city number one or Oakville and places like that. And if you don't have much money, well, what's left over? Right? And I was once in a focus group with some Somalis about housing discrimination, and they told a story how one of their friends arrived in Toronto, and he was beginning to look for a place, and they got together in the evening, and he said, yeah, I looked here and there, but it was already taken or whatever. And they said, okay, where did you look? And they laughed at him, why are you looking there? They're not going to rent to you there, right? You got to look here, right? Anyways, money buys choice. So it's people with no choice end up, frankly, these days in city number three. But remember, early on, I started by showing you how this area down here is still very low income, okay? So those areas are low income, but so are these areas, except they're not trending downwards. That's their only, right? They're mixing up a bit. Yes, they're gentrifying, but most of these areas here are not. Gentrification takes a long time. 110,000 people live Bathurst, Bloor, Roncesvalles, and the Lake. 110,000 people. That's the 22nd largest city in Canada for the city. Take a long time to gentrify all that. Yes, the shopping gets gentrified a bit in some parts of Bloor, of Queen West and all that, but. So these areas are doing a bit better. Poor South Parkdale, Jameson Avenue. We have outliers of city number three, St. Jamestown. Regent Park will soon be a different color on the map. Parkdale, South Parkdale. So in the cluster analysis, there's a couple, there's four or five census tracts that don't fit anything. There's nothing like St. Jamestown, right? There's nothing like Regent Park.
How did you do this with property values? If you drill down property values between 1970 and 2001, does it reflect exactly what
3, 2, and 1 are? And then you got to ask what determines property values and all that, right? Yeah, there's in the census, people self-identify what they think their house is worth if they own it, and then what their rents. Yeah, no, the problem is getting 40 years. You can get 10 years of data or something, but not 40 years. Yeah. Other questions? Yes?
Can you refer back to the map where you had the 2025?
The doomsday, somebody called it the doomsday map. Getting there? Yep.
Indicated that half of Toronto's renters are in
city
number three.
As of now. Yeah.
And I'm guessing most of Toronto's homeowners are on the subway line in city number one.
Sorry?
Half of Toronto's homeowners or some of Toronto's homeowners are on city number one in the subway line.
I'm not sure, but what do you...
With the subway extension to your university, how do you think that will affect city number three? I've seen that Finch Avenue turn, Finch Station turned into a low-income neighborhood with your projection in 2025.
So remember, this projection is if nothing changes. So indeed, the subway line curves up this way, doesn't it? And we have this subway line right now, and what might happen there? It depends. In Vancouver, one of the first SkyTrain routes went out to Surrey, It went through the east end of Vancouver, which is gentrifying, but it was the poor part of the city, and then into Surrey, and parts of Surrey are city number three, okay, are very poor and trending downwards. Having the SkyTrain there makes no difference. If the housing stock is sort of crummy, you got crummy industry there, you got crummy wasted whatever kind of space there, right? So if there's some amenity value to a neighborhood, and a subway or a transit line goes through, yeah, it could upgrade, gentrify the area, but not necessarily. So there isn't a direct connection, because we can find many examples where the subway line made no difference.
Okay, I think we have to end it here. You want to take one more?
Well, up to, yeah, if you have the time.
Just quickly.
Sorry?
I should make a point about the last subway line.
Yes, a little bit louder, please. Well, yeah. See, if condominiums are built, ownership housing is built along the line, that's going to mix up the census tract. Low-income people, by definition, won't buy those condos because they can't afford them or get a mortgage, right? Yeah, so then the census tract will show up as the ones in the downtown area are showing up as still poor maybe, but trending upward a little bit, that they are mixed. I think a healthy city is mixed. Not every census tract has to be mixed, but to have such solid clusters is the problem, right? Now, very briefly then, we were beginning to do the same analysis for Montreal and Vancouver because we collected the same data in the same way. The city's geography, history, and all that makes a difference. So they don't have the same clustering. Like we're ending up with three chunks. There's a little bit here, a little bit there, and all that. There's the same trends, but the geography is totally different. It's more mixed up. So not every city will cluster the way Toronto has. We have a lake on the bottom and a historic pattern of growth there.
And that is the question for the next talk, because if the priority neighborhood is a spatial strategy to fend off these kinds of trends, will spatial strategies even be effective if it isn't a spatial thing? But if it is actually a social thing. But
Right.
Will you come next time?
But we need both. We need both.
We have to keep the dialogue going. I was very happy to get David here on short notice, so please join me in thanking him for his presentation. You have heard the PDF file for this is going to be on the City Institute website. I believe there are probably still a few copies of the brochure over here. If you didn't get one, pick one up. Please come back the first Friday of March. Simon Black of the City Institute is going to give a presentation on his PhD work at that time. It's the next city seminar. I believe it's back in York Lanes at that time, in 305 York Lanes on March the 4th at 12:30. Thank you for coming and have a good weekend.
All right.
Good. Yep.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm glad I had the opportunity. It forced me to get to work on city number three. Yes. I've got to write this up.
Excellent. Let me pull this out.
Richard Ford has got this crazy idea that people are moving to where the jobs are falling. This is really not that. Location is more
important. Yeah.
I forgot that people don't. That's what's determining people. Intuition, right? Not your intuition.
Yeah, a little insight. Which is marketing and not properly
developed. Yeah.
So we don't have much to do with each other, but I get it. No, I mean, it's not a game about picking a fight.
No.
So that's why we ignore each other.
Okay.
He props up this credentials for caring about the poor by mentioning my work.
Really? What's your work?
He mentions this often. No, that this is an unfortunate trend and all that, right?
So
he acknowledges that he
takes your idea and manipulates it.
Well, no.